Well, that was worth waiting for, wasn't it? Thank you so much. We've been really blessed this morning. By the way, O Holy Night is one of my favorite pieces of music. I enjoyed that this morning, didn't you? And the unexpected treat of a young lady from Virginia that stood up here. And were you overwhelmed like I was? I saw this young girl stand up here and I thought, well, this will be interesting. And out came a voice that seemed to belong to a much older individual. God's giving a lot of beautiful gifts, isn't he? Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. As I look around the church this morning, I just feel like praising God. I see so many individuals here that I really wish to offer my personal praise and thanks to. I mean, John and I.D. Freeman sitting down the front here, you may not know this, but several months ago when I was preaching at Fletcher, not this last time but the time before, I was embarrassed because the cover of my Bible was actually fallen off and I had taped it. And it looked so grotty. And John, who has an eye for detail, being a photographer and all that, as I walked out, and I was so excited to see them, but he was more interested in seeing my Bible. And he basically plucked it out of my hand and he said, you'll have it back on Wednesday. And I said, what's he talking about? And look what he's had done with my Bible. Thank you so much. I mean, this is the greatest blessing that could have happened to me, because you have all your notes in a Bible like this, and the thought of transferring them all, and the thing I appreciate the most is that all the pages that were out are all back in again. It's a miracle. So God is good, isn't he? Do I look to you this morning as though I'm ready to conduct something? I mean, I'm dressed very particularly this morning. Did you notice? What would you expect me to be conducting if possibly? I even put the tie on to match this. I hate to be drawing attention to my own demeanor this morning, but I am wearing my, what I call my wedding tie, because this is my wedding suit that I use to conduct weddings in, and it happens to be the only warm suit I've got with me too. That's why I'm wearing it. But on Saturday night, I was in California and Santa Cruz. And I had been invited to conduct a wedding in Modesto. Now, if you know the distance from Santa Cruz to Modesto, you know you've got to come up 17 and over that hill and down into Santa Cruz, and then pick up the roads to find your way to Modesto, out in the valley there. And all of the well-intentioned people around me told me you can make this trip in 2 hours. I said to myself, it sometimes takes ages to get across the mountain, depending on the traffic. And, you know, that Route 17 is one of the windiest roads in the country. But all of my well-intentioned friends told me 2 hours at a max. And one of them even wrote out the quickest and the shortest way to get from Santa Cruz to Modesto. So the lady who was getting married, who happened to be a former church member of mine from Las Vegas days, and she especially wanted me to conduct this wedding. I mean, these were some of the oldest friends I have, as well as you guys, by the way, in this country. And so I said, well, I'm conducting a seminar at Santa Cruz. This is not very convenient. She said, well, we'll have the wedding at a time convenient to you. So I just plucked a figure out of my head and I said, well, 7 o'clock Saturday night. If you're willing to wait till 7 o'clock, I will conduct the wedding. Which means I have to leave the seminar early. But luckily I have an associate there that could take over. So I said, I'll leave the seminar at 4 o'clock. That'll give me 3 hours to get to Modesto. And a young man who was also invited to the wedding said, well, could I travel with you and I will be your guide? I looked at him, I said, you know the way? He said, I know it like the palm of my hand. Well, I don't know the palm of my hand very well. You know, maybe you do, but I don't. And he said, I even have a map. Oh, I said, great. I feel better when there's a map. And so I agreed that he would accompany me. So at 4 o'clock, we left the seminar at Santa Cruz. We had no problem getting over the mountain. fortunately. And then we had to make a decision. Now, I know the way I would have gone, and I always arrive where I'm going, interestingly enough. And, you know, there's a lot hanging on this. Here's my old friend getting married, and I'm to perform the wedding, and they've delayed it in time for me to arrive. So I'm very conscious of the fact that this whole wedding has been planned around my schedule. So I'm making every effort to do the right thing. And this young man says to me, well, we should take 85. Well, I wouldn't go 85 if it was me. I would go down and pick up 280, which runs to 680, which connects to 580, and that'll take us there. He said, but this is a shortcut. And because we're coming up to the big sign, 85, you know, the big freeway, he said, exit here. He said, now, I'm your guide, remember. I'm navigating. You just focus on driving. Never again will I just focus on driving. So I chose not to look at the signs. I chose to allow the navigator to direct me. And when I'm driving alone, as you do, I watch every sign, don't you? But if I've got a navigator who knows absolutely where he's going, I don't check the signs. So I'm very casually driving along, and I took the exit to 80, 85. And as soon as you exit, you're given three choices. And I wasn't watching. So I just saw 85, and I headed for it without realizing there were three divisions in the road at this moment. And I found myself heading into downtown San Jose. And I said to this guy, we should not be heading into San Jose. We need to be going north. I said, no, we're on the right track. I said, well, you know, I do know San Jose. I go there often enough. And I know that we ought not to be heading, especially Saturday night, downtown San Jose with all that ridiculous traffic they have there. I said, we have to get off this road. We need to do a U-turn. We've done something wrong. He said, well, there is another shortcut we can pick up from here. And I still trusted this guy. I said, well, what is it? He said, well, if we do a U-turn, which took us about 15 minutes to be able to do a U-turn here, he said, we can pick up 280. And I said, oh, thank you, 280. That's the road I wanted to be on. So we finally did a U-turn, and we're going back up, and then we saw the sign, 280. Oh, I said, wonderful. I'm feeling so much more relieved already because I'm watching the time. But 280 gave us two choices. 280 north, which heads to San Francisco. I knew that. Or 280 south. Now, to me, I'm heading north because I know that I've got to be heading north to get across to Modesto. And so I said to this guy, okay, we have two choices here. I said, it's quite simple, we're going north, and that was very confirming to me. Of course, there was only one problem, we should have gone south. Because if you take 280 south within half a mile, you pick up 680. And so we took 280 north. And I said to the guy, we are heading into downtown San Francisco. I've gone from downtown San Jose, and I'm now heading, I'm in line to go across the Bay Bridge. And you know what the San Francisco traffic's like? About 10 miles short of the Bay Bridge, it was stopped, bumper to bumper, and I'm watching my watch. And this guy turns to me and he says, well, obviously we went the wrong way on 280. I said, do you have any further suggestions? I can't believe I trusted him a third time. And he said, well, we probably now should just go across the Bay Bridge. And on the other side of the Bay Bridge, we will pick up 580, which runs straight to Modesto. So he had a cell phone there. I said, call this friend of mine in Modesto. He said, what for? I said, I want to know how long it takes to go from, if we ever get across the Bay Bridge, that is, how long does it take to go from the other side of the Bay Bridge to Modesto? So he called this friend of mine in Modesto, and they said, well, it normally takes about 2 hours. It's now 5:30, and the wedding's at 7 o'clock. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that instead of the bride being the last person to arrive at the wedding, the pastor will be the last person to arrive at the wedding. Can you imagine how embarrassing that would be? And I had visions of the whole wedding party standing there and no pastor. Oh, I said, this, and I'm wearing my wedding suit and all. This is my worst nightmare. I mean, this is truly embarrassing to me. I've never missed a wedding in my life. And he said, well, we'll get across the bridge and we might just make it. I said, even at 100 miles an hour, and we're not even moving. We're sitting here. He said, well, maybe if we go back to San Jose and start again. I said, yeah. Great suggestion. So that's when I decided, well, I'm not even going to go across the Bay Bridge. Why would I put myself through all that? I'm not going to make the wedding. So I said, get on the phone again and call the bride-to-be. Hopefully she won't be there and I can leave her a message. My prayer was answered. And then I called another friend in Modesto and we passed the word on, and luckily the pastor of the church was able to step in. So the wedding was saved. So we drove back to San Jose. We drove all the way back to Santa Cruz. He dropped me off at the house where I was staying with some friends there. It's like midnight. Well, we stopped to eat as well, you know. It's important to have your priorities at a time like this. And I went into the house and I'm creeping into the house. Not that my friend that owns this house creeps around the house. He's a surfer. And he knows that I'm not a great lover of cats. So they lock the cats. They have half a dozen cats, and they lock them in the garage while I'm staying. I sleep on the sofa in the living room. And every morning at about 5 o'clock in the morning, he gets up. He hasn't yet learned that when you open the door into the garage, six cats race into the house. And every morning that I'm there, I wake up and I see this figure tearing around the sofa, chasing cats, trying to catch them. I mean, you don't get a lot of sleep in this house, you know? Anyway, I got to the house and he was already in bed. His wife was sitting up. She was in tears. And I had just a few weeks earlier really ministered seriously to her husband. And as I walked into the living room, I said, oh, you're still up? She said, yeah. She said, what are you doing back here? I said, don't ask me. She said, how did the wedding go? I said, I don't know. Well, I said, don't worry about weddings. What's up with you? And she opened up. And I had the most beautiful ministry. This is an old friend of mine in major pain and crisis. And all of a sudden, my mind went click, click, click. And you know what it said to me? I wasn't meant to be at the wedding. God had more important business for me to do. And according to his great providence and direction, this whole evening, which to me seemed so messed up and I'm still embarrassed about. I'm waiting for the bride to get back from her honeymoon before I call her. She's only got my telephone message at the moment. But despite the fact that the night was so messed up, God in his infinite wisdom took advantage of this whole situation, knew about it in advance, of course, and arranged for me to have the sweetest time in ministry with somebody that was just in absolute pain. And I looked up and I said, you know, you are truly incredible. You have such a sense of priorities. You care so much for human beings that you actually allowed me to go through all this agony just so I could get back here at midnight in order to be able to minister your love to somebody that was truly in absolute agony. And I just lifted up my heart and I said, thank you for being that kind of God. And I'm thinking of a man this morning. It's an unusual situation biblically because, you know, God is into the business of changing names, isn't he? He takes a Jacob and he makes him Israel. But I'm thinking of a man this morning who began with a Hebrew name and ends up with a Roman name. And that gives you cause for thought. His name was originally Saul. But he is well known to us as the Apostle Paul. His Hebrew name, which was Saul, is now gone in favor of a Roman name, Paulus. Now, there's a reason for this, because he becomes the great apostle to the Gentiles. And so it's in his best interest to have a name that the Gentiles can identify with. God knows this. Because even in the change of a name, God is still interested in reaching human hearts. There are just four things this morning that we can learn from the conversion experience of the Apostle Paul. So open your Bibles with me to Acts, the 7th chapter. Acts chapter 7. There's probably 400 things we can learn, but I'm choosing four of them this morning because they stand out and they reveal a great deal about God himself. The context of our story begins in chapter 7, where we have the experience of the stoning of Stephen. I almost decided to preach on Stephen this morning, but I switched over to Paul when I realized that the lessons were so outstanding here from the experience of Paul. But I just want you to notice the first time we run into Saul, and notice the context which we encounter him in. Acts 7, verse 58. This is the first mention of him here. Stephen now being driven out of the city. They began stoning him, and the witnesses laid their robes at the feet of a young man named Saul. This was an indication, by the way, of the authority that Saul had. And for witnesses to lay their garments like this at his feet was almost a way of saying, I have legal authority to do what I'm doing. So right from the beginning, we recognize we're looking at a man of some significance. Stephen, of course, died a marvelous death, didn't he? What a death. I've always believed that great men should die great deaths. They shouldn't just fade away in a hospital bed somewhere. They've lived great lives, and so it's very fitting that they go out with a bang too, because that's the way they've lived their lives. To the full, they have no fear of death. Those who've got confidence in God don't fear death. What is death? It's asleep. It's not really even death. It's only temporary. Real death, of course, is another matter. From my experience, by the way, only those who've resolved the real death issue can die peacefully with the loss of this body, which is nothing. And so Stephen died a great death. Look at 59. They went on stoning Stephen as he called upon the Lord. I love that statement, don't you? Imagine those stones hitting him. Well, these are not little stones. They're picking up boulders and throwing them at him. And as they're landing on his body, what's he doing? He calls upon the Lord and says, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. But then he goes one step further, falling on his knees now, no doubt he's getting weaker. He cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. Isn't that beautiful? That is so powerful to do that, to die like that. What an impact it must have made on those who were watching. Do you think it made an impression on Saul? Well, you better believe it. Saul had never witnessed anything like this in his whole life. And here's a man dying with dignity, dying with courage, dying without fear and intimidation. I remember very well when I was pastoring in Las Vegas, one of our school teachers there, in fact, he was teaching my older son at the time. I think he was the sixth grade teacher or something. He was at home with his wife and he had a fatal heart attack. And his wife was holding him and he fell down to his knees and he said to her, he must have known, he said, I've only got a few minutes. So he said, don't call 911, just stay with me. And he fell down on his knees and he began to pray. His wife told me this story herself. And she said she could hardly believe it as her husband opened his mouth and began to pray. Do you know what he prayed for? She said he listed all the children in his class, including your son. I thought, wow. And she said he called them by name And he invoked the blessing of God on their lives, saying he would not be able to continue to shape them. And she said, then he smiled and he went to sleep. Do you think I had a lot of joy in conducting that funeral? I've never had a more joyful time, if I could say that, in conducting a funeral. There was so much praise. Several members of his own family were healed just through the funeral service. I run into them periodically. They remind me about it. I said, that was the most positive funeral. I said, I felt it myself. Because here's a man who lived what he believed, and dying was not the end of that, not at all. He was just simply going into the arms of Jesus to be awakened and continue on with the same relationship that he already had with Jesus Christ. You know that it's all about relationships, don't you? Salvation is about relationships. It's not all the knowledge you've got. It's not your ability to defend all your doctrines. Salvation is all about knowing Jesus. And if you know Jesus, the sleep of death is nothing at all but the next step into being fully with him the moment you open your eyes. Nothing at all to be feared. And Stephen certainly had that confidence, didn't he? Ellen White says that from this moment on, Saul was troubled in his spirit. He had never witnessed faith in action like this, especially at the point of death. And it troubled his spirit. He could not sleep. And he did something that is absolutely fascinating to me. I want you to notice how he acted out the conviction that was beginning to build inside him. And it leads to our first point this morning. Chapter 8, verse 1. Acts 8, verse 1. Saul was in hearty agreement. You like the word hearty there? He wasn't just approving. He was in hearty agreement with putting him to death. And on that day, a great persecution arose against the church, especially the church in Jerusalem. And they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. Of course, you know that the scattering was a part of God's plan too, don't you? Because that very scattering became the means of planting little Christian churches everywhere. Point number one, you should expect opposition. I'm fascinated by how many Christians I run into who think that the Christian path is always to be moonlight and roses. And they forget that there's a lot of daylight and dishes out there. It's like romance. It's not all moonlight and roses. A lot of daylight and dishes. I saw the look on Connie's face this morning, Ray, when you offered to finish up the dishes. I mean, she was almost transported with joy, wasn't she? I love that expression that women get on their face. It's wonderful. There are periods of moonlight and roses in the Christian life, but there's a lot of daylight and dishes. And if you're not expecting opposition, I want you to challenge your own thinking this morning, because Jesus taught it over and over again. Just compare Matthew 10 for a moment, and notice what he led us to expect. Matthew chapter 10. Just picking out a few verses here to remind you of the teachings of Jesus. Matthew 10, I'm looking at 17 and 18 to begin with. Beware of men. What will they do to you? They'll deliver you up to the courts and scourge you in their synagogues. You'll even be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. Did you hear that? Why is God going to bring you before governors and kings? As a testimony. Well, some courageous soul in the church this morning is probably saying to themselves, oh my goodness, that is the meaning of a great statement in the book of Revelation. The testimony of, that is the testimony of Jesus. When you testify of what the Father has done for you. That's the meaning of the testimony of Jesus. Too bad we've relegated that to one person. This is the business of the whole body. The testimony of Jesus. Opposition is so that God, through you, can bring conviction to the hearts and lives of those who may yet be struggling, like Saul. Moving on in Matthew 10 there, notice 21 and 22. Does it come close to family? Family's pretty important, isn't it? I know many, by the way, who place their blood relationships above every other thing. Dangerous philosophy. Jesus taught over and over again that my brothers and sisters are those who do the will of my Father. Notice 21 and 22. Brother will deliver up brother to death. A father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all on account of my name, but it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. Should we expect opposition? Why did Jesus spend so much of his teaching warning us to be prepared? And the last verse here, verse 36 in Matthew 10. A man's enemies, the members of his own household, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Something I'm learning about Christianity, it gives you the right priorities. It doesn't mean that you don't love your blood relatives, but not more than Christ. He is to be first. My mother, by the way, has just sent me an ultimatum. My adventurous mother, who's just visited me over here, is going to go to New Guinea to visit my brother that's been there for 35 years and has never been home. She hasn't seen him for 35 years. I saw him a lot while I was there. He's an adventurous guy, my brother. He's polygamous. He has two wives. He's a good New Guinean. He has 19 children. And he's now the chief of the tribe of 5,000 people. He doesn't speak English. He looks like a New Guinean. His skin has gone so dark from living on the equator all these years. And my mother, I guess, because she's in her 80s now, she's decided she'd like to see her missing child that she hasn't seen for 35 years. And she wants me to take her there, which I'm happy to do if she fits into my schedule. And so she's just sent me a message saying, I'm going to New Guinea in February with or without you. So I've just sent her back a message and saying, well, you're going without me, because I'm tied up for the whole month of February. I'm running seminars in New Zealand the entire month. She knows that. She's putting pressure on me. So she's now sent me a second message on my answering machine. She says, but you've been telling me how dangerous it is today to go to New Guinea. Are you going to let me go alone? She said, you better start praying for me. That's pressure, you know. So I've just sent her back a message. I said, Mother, I've been reflecting on your last message, and I've decided I'm starting to pray for the New Guineans. They are probably in graver danger from you than you are from them. So this thing's at a standstill at the moment, but I'm going to be in Australia for Christmas, and I'm sure Mother's waiting to hit me with this to see if we can't come to some kind of agreement. But it looks like she may be going to New Guinea on her own. I challenge anyone in New Guinea to attack my mother. She'll be invoking the Lord's hosts against them, you know. They won't get far. Are you putting family above your relationship to Christ? Are you? Are you tempted to compromise or to deny yourself spiritual growth and reality in the name of family? Consider the words we've just read. Because one of the first lessons we learn from the experience of Saul is that Christians have every reason to expect opposition. And when it happens, you are going to find strength. strength and support where? Huh? Where are you going to find your chief support from at a time like this? Ron, I saw you going like this then. What were you thinking? From the family of God. And you may have a blood relative, but if they're not praising God and serving Christ, that will not be your support. It will come from those who love the Lord and who have bonded with you and have become one in Christ. Now, I know that this is the South, but can we get an amen to that? God is gracious. This is such a significant principle. And I see so many depriving themselves of spiritual growth and blessing, and it's always done in the name of family. Turning back to Acts, please, back to Acts chapter 8. Well, now we're going to actually now move into chapter 9. First point, expect opposition. Plan for it and develop a network of caring, praying, loving friends. You'll never know how much you will need that until you are plunged into crisis. But when you're into crisis, that's when you know whether you're really in a body or not. Do you know what the average Christian does when they get into crisis? They withdraw like the turtle. And we say, where are they? Haven't seen them for a while. Some of them go back into the bosom of families that really don't understand the spiritual nature of the crisis that they may be passing through. Second point. I love this aspect. By the way, God uses crisis to great advantage. You know that, don't you? Second point, Acts chapter 9. Now Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked for letters from him to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, both men and women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. What's Saul doing? Where is he now seeking support from? Which represents spiritual leadership at the highest levels. He actually goes to the spiritual leaders and seeks their authority to persecute anybody belonging to, notice the word, isn't it a beautiful word there? The way. The way. It was dangerous to belong to the way. But remind yourselves, what is Saul really doing? He's a man who is convicted in his heart. And he's not yielding to that conviction. He's acting it out in a very militant manner. Whenever you see somebody acting out in a militant manner. I told any of you that were at Fletcher a couple of weeks ago, you would have heard me tell the story of my recent visit to London just 2 weeks ago, where my niece had been begging me to come back to London and convert her French boyfriend. He's 30 years of age. I've met him now 4 times, and every time I meet him, he wants to argue and debate French philosophy with me. Rousseau, Voltaire, the great humanistic thinkers of the age, he wants to debate humanism with me. I've had the most fruitless times with this young man. And my niece is a Seventh-day Adventist from Australia, but living in London. Of course, I manage every now and again to ask her what she's doing, dating a man for 5 years who's not a believer in God. But she won't let him go, but neither will she marry him unless he becomes a Christian. And this year she gave him an ultimatum. This is the final year. He said, for what? She said, well, if you don't become a Christian this year, I'm done with you. Well, he said, I've been good enough for 4 years. She said, I know, but I keep hoping you're going to change. You can see she has struggles of her own. I gently remind her of these matters every now and again. But this year she said to me, please, this is Olivier's last chance. You are his last chance. I said, really, I'm in a very privileged position, aren't I, to be Olivier's last chance. So in the providence of God, 2 weeks ago, I was able to have a week in London. My niece was thrilled. And she arranged on the Sunday for us to spend the entire day together. I was looking forward to my regular philosophical discussions, as you can imagine, with great relish. And that morning I went out and looked up into the sky and I said to God, it's not working. 4 times I've met with this guy and we've made no progress whatsoever. And you know how good God is. He went click. He said, well, why don't you change your method? I said, I'm open to suggestion. And God said to me, no discussion. I said, thank you. No argument, no debate. I said, thank you, thank you. He said, why don't you challenge Olivier to prove me, to give me 24 hours to prove to him that I exist? I said to God, do you think he'd be willing to do that? God said, do it over dinner tonight in the restaurant you're going to. I didn't even know I was going to a restaurant yet. I said, in a restaurant? He said, yes. And God said to me, interestingly enough, don't concentrate on anybody else. Just focus on Olivier. So I went round to my niece's house. Her name is Samantha. She had another friend there, a young French woman. She likes French people. Named Frederic. And Frederic is also an agnostic. And so I've got an agnostic and an atheist. And my niece, who's a sort of a semi-Adventist. And we're sitting there and we're having a fun day. And Olivier says, well, I had a chat with your God this morning. Oh, I said, you've been out talking to the one who doesn't exist. It's a dangerous sign, Olivier, to be chatting with someone that doesn't exist. And he grinned and he said, well, would you like to know what I said to him? I said, I'd be thrilled. And he said, well, I cursed him. He said, would you like to hear exactly what I said? Yes, I said, I've heard it all. It won't shock me. He said, well, and I won't use the words here this morning, but he called God a BB. And one of those words is a term we use for an illegitimate child. He said, that's what I called your God this morning. I stood outside and I just said, you are a mm-mm, if you're there. And I looked at him and I said, Olivier, it's a good sign. He can't handle this. I said, that is a good sign, because you would never have done that unless there is some growing conviction. It's like the apostle here. He's beginning to get so convicted that he's acting it out against everybody who represents the very thing that he's being convicted about. And who's Paul focusing his energies on? He's not going after the Jews, who are troublemakers to the Romans. Who's he going after? The Christians. Why? Because Stephen has shown him not only how to live and how to die, but how to die generously, forgiving all your enemies even as they kill you. He can't stand it. And the Spirit of God is beginning to warm his heart. Well, Olivier is the same. I knew this. I said, it's a great sign, Olivier. And we're sitting at dinner now in a restaurant later that afternoon, a great restaurant in the Chelsea area of London, beautiful area. And the four of us are sitting there. I'm laughing to myself. I've got an agnostic and an atheist, and I sort of told me the very words I am to say to you. And this year, Olivier, I'm sorry to tell you, this is it. This is the year that you are about to cease to be an unbeliever. And you are about to become a believer. He said, never. And I said, I have even greater news for you. It's going to happen within the next 60 minutes. You are about to move from unbelief into belief. The seed is to be planted in the next 60 minutes, and within 24 hours, you will have crossed over. And he just laughed his head off. I said, hey, laugh all you like. It's about to happen. And he looked at me with serious. What does your God tell you? Oh, I said, you really want to know? He said, yeah. I said, well, my God told me that I was to challenge you to give him 24 hours to prove to you that he does exist. He said, well, that's a good idea. I think it's an excellent idea. He said, how would I do this? I said, well, God even gave me the words that you could say. So he pulled out a pen. He said, well, let me write them down. I said, God, if you are there, I give you permission during the next 24 hours to come into my mind and my life and do whatever it takes to convince me that you really do exist. I said, of course, Olivier, there's a risk involved in this. It's probably too risky for somebody like you. You know, the French men all have big egos, I knew that. So by telling him that I thought it was too risky, I knew that he would take the bait. I had the hook in, I'm now starting to reel it in, you know. He said, what do you mean risky? I said, well, it's going to affect you. He hates the homeless. He has embarrassed me to death. We walk down the street, he wants to kick the homeless. Literally kick them. They have no business being like this. And he'll push them out of the way. I wouldn't help you. I've challenged him and rebuked him many a times. I said, hey, this is a risk for you, Olivier, because if God does reveal himself to you, the next time you look at a homeless man, instead of wanting to kick him, you would feel compassion. You might even go and put your arm around him. I said, God forbid, but you might put your hand in your pocket. I know how unlikely that is. But you might actually put your hand in your pocket and produce some money. Think of how scary that would be to you. So I said, this is a big risk and probably bigger than you, actually. I don't see you willing to take a risk like this. He said, I could be willing. Oh, I said, you'd have to be a real man to take a risk like this. In fact, you'd have to be so sure of your position before you could ever take a risk like this. Only a man who was totally confident of where he stood would ever put himself in a position to take a risk like this. I'm really now reeling it in. This is the big one. Only a man that was totally sure. He said, I'll do it. I said, really? I said, think of the risk. Think of what it's going to do to you. He said, nothing will happen to me. And I'm still reeling him in. He said, 24 hours. I said, when will you start? God told me to apply it to him right there and then. When will you do it? He said, the moment you leave the country. I said, why? He said, because I don't want anyone influencing me. I wish to do this alone. Just between me and your imaginary God. I said, deal. He said, when are you leaving? I said, I'm leaving Wednesday afternoon. He said, Wednesday night I will do it. So as you can imagine, I couldn't wait to get home and read my emails. And my niece emailed me on Thursday morning. He did it. And enclosed are 4 pages of questions that he's asked already, mostly to do with the understanding of the person of Jesus Christ. I said, hallelujah. She said, I drove Frederick to the airport, this young French girl, not to the airport, to the railway station to catch the train home. And on the way to the railway station, my friend Frederick began to weep. This was an unknown thing to me. And she said, it turns out that in sitting there listening, without anything being directed at her, she has been convicted by the Spirit and would like to open her heart up to find out the truth about God. She said, I can't believe it. She says, in one day, my 2 closest friends have opened their hearts to the Spirit of God. She said, I need you here for a month now to follow up on this. But I'm just telling you this to let you know, God uses unusual things, doesn't he? I mean, he uses really unusual approaches. What did he do with Saul? I mean, look at it, what God did. Have a look at Acts 9, verse 3. He's journeying to Damascus. And as he approaches Damascus, a light from heaven flashes all around him. In verse 7, if you jump down to verse 7, the men who traveled with him stood speechless They heard the voice, but they saw no one. And Saul got up from the ground in verse 8, and what condition was he in? He's blind. He could see nothing. And leading him by the hand, they brought him into Damascus. Now I'm asking you this morning, does God specialize in using the unusual? Well, he does. God will do whatever it takes. He is so focused on reaching human hearts. Here's this proud, educated, militant Jewish Roman man, a man in authority, a man who has what it takes to go to the high priest and get letters to persecute Christians. He's hounding them, hunting them, because in his heart he's convicted that Stephen had something that he didn't have. And he sensed it was something to do with God. So God decided to use the unlikely. A light from heaven. Think about that. A light from heaven. Falling down on the ground. Voices being heard by people. But he's the only one actually hearing what it's saying. And he gets up off his knees and he's totally blind. I want to challenge you, by the way, if you ever get bold enough to give God permission to do whatever it takes to reach the heart of a loved one or a friend who may not be sensing their need of God, you'd better be prepared for God to do something quite unlikely and quite unusual. And please do not be offended when it happens, because you begin to learn after a while that there's nothing accidental in the life of a believer. You know that, don't you? Because when I'd finished with Olivier, I got ready to leave London. I went out to Heathrow Airport, big airport. I arrived several hours early because I've been caught there before. And I'm just strolling along, knowing I've got plenty of time. I'm strolling along and I come past the television monitors and I just scan down to look for Washington Dulles, which I'm flying into. And to my great surprise, there's another flight leaving in 30 minutes. I thought, wow, how come they didn't tell me about that flight? I could get home so much earlier. How much nicer to arrive back in Washington at 4 o'clock in the afternoon instead of 10 o'clock in the evening. So I rushed over to the counter and there was a young lady there and I said, you know, I notice you've got a flight leaving in 30 minutes' time. I'd love to get on it. I'm not booked till later this afternoon, but please, if there's any way I could get on, I would really like to get on that flight. It'll save me spending any time around the airport here. So she says, well? That look on her face, I knew something good was coming. It's not always that way. She said, well, there's only one seat left. I said, really? She said, but it's a very good seat. It's a business class seat. Well, I said, you know, I was just about to ask you if you'd like to give me a free upgrade. So I'd be more than happy to take it. Of course, I'm not willing to pay any extra, though. She grinned at me. She said, you know, I like your boldness. I said, well, some people do and some don't. She said, you can have it. Oh, I said, thank you, thank you. So now I'm going to have a business class seat. How nice. I won't be jammed in with all the other sardines. Now I said, tell me again, did you say there's only one seat left? She said, yes. Oh, and I lifted up my hands. I said, thank you. She said, what are you doing? Oh, well, I said, I should let you know that how many seats are together? She said, there's two seats together in business class. I said, well, I'm just thanking God because the person who's in the other seat is actually waiting to meet me. And she looked at me and she said, but you weren't even planning to be on this plane. I said, but God knew that. But even though I'm booked on the other flight, he intended me to be on this one. I don't live by accident. She said, that person is expecting to meet you. I said, well, they don't know it yet. But they are actually expecting to meet me. And I am about to have the most incredible experience with a captive audience for 7 hours. Oh, she said, no. I said, look, I tell you what, give me your name. And when I'm back in London, which I know I'm going to be to do some more work with Olivier, I would like to find you again at this desk and give you the rest of the story. Would you like to hear it? She said, absolutely. I want to hear the end of this story. And she just shook her head like this. So I walked onto the plane, knowing that God specializes in using the unlikely. Now, what's the likelihood of me getting on a flight that I've only just found out about, has only a business class seat left, which I'm not qualified for? Not likely. But God knew. He already knew that. He knows the end from the beginning. You do believe that, don't you? No accidental developments in your life. It wasn't an accident that Saul was walking to Damascus. Not at all. Anyway, I walked onto the plane and I sat down, and the seat next to me was vacant, so I started studying everybody coming in. Finally, a young lady. Young, of course, is a relative term, isn't it? I'm not sure how young she was. She looked to me to be maybe middle to late 30s. That was just my guess of it. Anyway, she excused herself and slid across in front of me and sat down. I thought, interesting. And she turned to me and she put out her hand. By the way, my name is Marie. So I put out my hand. I said, well, my name is Bill. And we both looked at each other and we burst out laughing, because both of us heard an Australian accent. And we both realized we are sitting next to a fellow Australian. Oh, I said, thank you, thank you. This is exciting. Australians are a tough bunch, you know, they're not easily reached. It's a very secular country. And I'm fairly confident that she has no kind of religious or spiritual background. Anyway, we start to chat. And so I said to her, well, what part of Australia are you from? And you know, there is a, if you come from Melbourne, people, you've probably, some of you have heard me say this same thing. If somebody asks you, where are you from? Your reply is always, well, there's only one civilized place in Australia. And that's what she said to me. And so I laughed my head off. I said, you know, we both come from the same place. Because Melbourne's a free city. There were no convicts involved in the establishment of Melbourne, unlike Sydney, which we never miss a chance to put down, of course. And we both laughed, and I said, what suburb are you from? And she was from a suburb about 5 miles from where I grew up, same side of the city. I said, well, we're from the same place, basically. Boy, I said, this is incredible. Yes, she said, what a coincidence. I said, yes, isn't it? Great coincidence. And so I started asking her about her life and what she did. She was a technical person for medical equipment, and she was traveling around the world teaching people how to use this huge medical equipment. And she was on her way to Austin, Texas, which I assured her would be an exciting place to visit at the moment. And I said, it'll either be in depression or there'll be celebration, one or the other. And so she spent a couple of hours talking about herself, and I kept drawing her out. And finally, of course, I knew that she would graciously return the favor, and she said to me, and what do you do? So I'm praying for wisdom now, because this is the transition point. I said, well, in a nutshell, I travel around the world sharing the good news of my Heavenly Father with people who are fortunate enough to be sitting next to me. And she looked at me and she burst out grinning. She said, well, that's me! I said, right! That's you! And I said, I want you to know something. It's not a coincidence that you are sitting here, because I was not even booked on this plane till 30 minutes ago. It was the only seat left. I have an economy class ticket, not a business class ticket. And here I am, per favor of United Airlines, sitting here next to you. I said, this is not a coincidence. She said, well, what does this mean for me? I said, it means a great deal for you, because I'm in the business of sharing something that I call good news. She said, you know, this is incredible. She said, 3 months ago, I did an evaluation of my life, and I realized that there is something missing from my entire life. And she said, I decided it was the spiritual realm. She said, I've got everything else. I'm educated. I'm well employed. I've got enough money. She said, I've got everything except a spiritual component in my life. And in the last several weeks, I've actually slipped into several different churches just to get a feel of what goes on in a church. I've never been to church in my life. I said, I can understand that. I grew up the same way. So she said, I'm actually searching at the moment. I said, well, what a coincidence. And I happen to have what you are searching for. I said, if you don't mind, I could pull out my textbook. And I pulled out my Bible. I said, if you're willing, I could share this with you. She said, I'm willing. I said, well, I want to warn you. If you take the risk of hearing this, I will have to then take the risk of asking you what you're going to do about it. No pressure. And you can tell me to, you know, mind my own business, but I will be asking you at the end of our little discussion whether you would like to act upon what you're hearing. She said, okay. She said, I'm a big girl, I can handle that. I said, great. So we shared the good news together, first time she'd ever heard it. Just like Saul, her heart was touched. And after a couple of hours of sharing together in the Word, she'd never read the Bible before. I said to her, now I did warn you about this moment, didn't I? What would you like to do with the information you have just received? Would you like to receive Jesus Christ yourself as your personal Savior? She said, well, I wouldn't know how to do that. I said, well, fortunately, you're in the hands of somebody who can guide you. If you're willing to take this step, I will help you to take it. She said, when? I said, well, what about now? She said, here in the plane? I said, yes, no better place. And so I had the privilege of leading this young lady to Christ. Right there in the plane. And better still, she's accepted an invitation from me to meet up with me again at Christmas time at my sister's house in Melbourne. And I've told her we'll be having a study group together and we would like her to come in and become a part of it, and she's agreed to do it. She's only just a few miles away from where my sister lives. Isn't God good? God specializes in using the unlikely, the most unexpected thing. That is God's specialty. Our challenge is to be walking in the Spirit so we never miss when God is moving in a magnificent manner. Two things have come out so far. What was the first thing? Expect opposition. Don't be surprised. Don't be put off. Don't be thrown by it. It's coming. Secondly, God uses the unlikely. And if you find yourself in a difficult situation in the days ahead, don't be surprised if God uses the unlikely to bring about your deliverance, because that's what God does. In fact, God says, my strength is made perfect through weakness. Wow. My strength is made perfect through weakness. How did Ananias handle the news that he was to go and minister to Saul? Have a look at verse 13, chapter 9, verse 13. When Saul goes to Damascus, God raises up Ananias. Another unlikely development here. And in verse 13, Ananias, who has been asked by God to go and lay his hands on Saul and open his eyes, Ananias says, what? I've heard from many about this man. We know this man. How much harm he did to the saints here in Jerusalem. And even now he's got authority from the priests to bind all who call upon your name. This is the reaction of Ananias. What are you asking me to do? This man is our greatest enemy. He's the opposition. But what's God doing? What principles coming through? God uses the most unlikely. And Saul was the most unlikely person. He's the number one opponent. And Ananias can hardly handle this, but fortunately he's obedient to the heavenly vision. And he does it. So if you see somebody who's unlikely, please reevaluate how you're looking at that person, won't you? They may, in fact, be a special candidate for God to use in the most marvelous manner. And their very opposition and acting out against something that we know to be true could, in fact, be an evidence that they're beginning to be convicted, like Olivier, acting out, cursing God to his face in the morning and in the evening, praying the prayer, I give you permission to come into my mind. I mean, the moment he did that, I knew he was doomed. Samantha said to me, how do you know something's going to happen? I said, because I know God. Olivier is the most unlikely person. He's swearing at God, whom he doesn't even believe in. A man who goes out in the morning and curses a non-person is convicted. All we've got to do is give God a little entering wedge and God will be in. I'm expecting now, of course, I'm getting emails every day now. When can I get back over there? They want to have all these studies and everything. You all know what's going to happen to Olivier. I feel myself, I better get my wedding suit ready. Yes. Number three, Acts chapter 9, verse 6. It's related to the second point. God doesn't let go easily. God does not let go. We humans let go, don't we? We almost give up on people. We look at their lifestyles, we look at their arrogance, we look at their resistance, and we say, that's hopeless. Who could have appeared to be more hopeless than Saul? He's Jewish, which means that his opposition's going to be even more bitter. He's angry, he's offended. He hates Christians, and it's all because he has conviction in his heart. God does not let go easily. Look at all the factors here in this story about God's unwillingness to let go. So I want to assure you this morning, even if you have reached the end of your human tether, God has not. Look at what he's done. He brought light. He blinded Saul. He tapped into a man and commanded him to go and lay hands on this man and open his eyes. Even though he's imprisoning Christians, standing by approving of the death of Stephen, would you have been tempted to let him go at that point? When you see somebody you love and care about stoned to death in front of you, would you have been tempted to say, that's Satan? He's crossed the line. That's what I would have said. What if you'd been God and you saw David lean over his balcony and spot Bathsheba, and you witnessed the adultery, the breakup of families, the murder of Uriah? What would you have been tempted to do with David? I would have let him go. But God is so gracious. You know what he said of David? He's a man after my own heart. I am absolutely intrigued by the persistence of God and his unwillingness to let even the most hardened sinner go. And it struck me one day as I was evaluating this, I said to myself, God understands what sin has done to the human race. He knows we didn't want it. Not one of us had a choice in the matter. We were born into it. We were slaves of sin before we even understood what was happening to ourselves. God knows this. My favorite text, by the way, in the whole Bible is that beautiful text in Psalms. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth those that fear him. For he knoweth our frame. He remembers we are but dust. That is such a magnificent promise. God knows our frame. He knows we are but dust. And he will not let us go, even if we're killing his saints, even if we're turning against everything we're convicted about, even if we're getting letters of permission to destroy the whole Christian church. Incredibly, God would not let Saul go. Does that tell you something about God? So please don't be hasty to give up on individuals who are resisting. It may be a sign, in fact, that God is taking hold of them and in his own inimitable manner drawing them unto himself. And finally, fourth point, verse 5. It's not a complete verse in my version because of the manuscript that was used here. There's something missing. Who has it out there in a version that's not the New American? Anyone have a King James version there? Please read it to us, would you? Verse 5. Yes. That last little phrase is missing in some versions because of the manuscript. There's a manuscript variation there. But it's a great little statement. He's not saying, why are you kicking against the pricks? He's saying, it's hard for you to kick against the pricks. And I've researched this word pricks here. And some versions actually have a variation on that. Anybody got a variation on that word out there? Goads, yes, goads. And it's actually a term associated with oxen and the driving of the oxen team. And the driver had this goad. It was sharp. It's a bit like spurs on a horse. And whenever the ox tended to veer off in the wrong direction, he would hit him with this goad, and the goad would cause the ox to pull back onto the track. Now, every now and again, the ox would get angry because he's being hit with the goad, and he would lash out and kick. And sometimes, because he's so closely tethered to another ox, he would kick the neighboring ox, and then the goad had to be used on that ox to bring that ox. And sometimes they actually had goads working on both sides of the team at once, because the kicking against the prick upset the fellow ox. I was fascinated to read this, but I'm also very fascinated by the terminology here. God is not saying, why are you kicking against the goads? But God is saying, it is hard. Now, there are some people who try and tell me, for example, that it's so much easier to let go of the things associated with the church and religion and really just have the freedom to live your life in the world without any of those pressures and things on you. I have news for you. That is not true. If you've tried it or if you've been there, I grew up like that. It is certainly not true. There is no peace. Do you know what Olivier, by the way, has just emailed me? He said, I've just realized that all my years of humanism, all my years of debating philosophy, he said, I've just realized I have no peace in my own heart. Just for him to acknowledge that is an incredible development. He said, my father's dying at the moment. He has nothing to hang on to, no hope for anything. And I've never been in a position to share anything with him because I got my thinking from him. And he said to me in an email just this week, he said, do you think it's possible that God has revealed himself for me in time for me now to be able to share with my own father? This guy is growing so rapidly, I can't keep up with him. He's speaking like a believer. I mean, and just a few days ago, he was cursing God. I want to tell you, if you're choosing to walk outside of the grace of God, it's a hard life. Having convictions in your heart and not acting upon them, what does that produce? What does James say it produces? And what does it result in? Instability. People that are convicted and don't act on it become unstable. That is a hard way to spend your life, isn't it? To be unstable, I can't think of a worse fate than to be unstable and to be blown about by every wind that blows. Is that fun to you? That's hard. What about a Christian who has misunderstandings can do what about them? They have grace to go to somebody and say, I'm sorry, I blew it. They can actually go to bed at night with peace of mind and a quiet conscience. But just imagine if you don't have the freedom and you hold grudges. I've seen it destroy people totally. You have no peace of mind. You have no quiet conscience. Whatever you do, don't miss the meaning of this passage this morning. It is hard to kick against the pricks. Because those goads, those pricks, are God's way of doing what with us? Keeping us on a path where we can ultimately glorify Him in our whole lives. That's His goal for us. And it's painful because every time we step out of line, God has a way of confronting us, doesn't He? If you're anything like me, He hits my head against the wall 100 times until I finally say, okay, I get it. And I'm willing to act. Can you believe that God once asked me to read one of the Old Testament prophets? He actually said to me, it was almost as good as getting a letter from God. He woke me up one night and said, read that particular prophet, one of the minor prophets. And you know what I said to God? No. I'm not willing to read it. I can't believe I did that. And so the next day, God convicted me again. And I turn on the radio in my car, and guess what the preacher's preaching on? I said, stop it. And I turned the radio off. Because I knew if I read that particular prophet, I know that prophet. I knew that if I read that prophet, I would be called to do something that was so painful and so distasteful to me. At the human level now, I'm confessing at the human level, I could not ever see myself doing that. And in 100 different ways, for 6 months, I held out. It's my biggest period of rebellion ever since I've been a Christian. 6 months, I refused to read that prophet. I preached all around it, but I never mentioned that prophet. Ever. I refused to read it. I wouldn't even think about it. But God kept confronting me. You may find this hard to believe, but a homeless man actually challenged me in Santa Monica when I was walking down the street. I like to talk to the homeless. And this homeless man looked at me and he said, you don't seem to be at peace. I said, well, thank you very much. I was about to give you some money, but I don't think I will now. And I said, what led you to say that? He said, I don't know. He said, I just looked at you and I said, you don't seem to be at peace. And I said, ah, you've done it again. How could you use a homeless man to tell me that? That's how hardened I was, and I still didn't respond. So you know what God finally did? He used the most unlikely means of getting my attention. I was kicking against the pricks. What God was wanting me to do, having read that prophet, would have glorified God and it would have strengthened me and my peace of mind would have come back. But sometimes we allow our humanity to get in the way, don't we? So you know what God used to get my attention? He gave three people, all on the same night, the same dream about me. That's pretty scary. One of these persons was in Tennessee. One was in Los Angeles. And the third one, this is what rocked me, was a friend of mine, a Muslim, who worked in the World Bank and was on a mission in Cambodia. And the first person in Tennessee called me up and said, you know, I had a dream about you last night. I said, oh, it's great that you have such incredible subjects to dream about, you know. And what was the nature of this dream? Well, you were wearing a dark suit. I said, well, rather unusual. Hmm? And you were teaching a seminar. I said, well, what's new? And in the middle of the seminar, you began to shake. So they had my attention now. I said, okay, I began to shake. And a man walked in, he was holding a gun. I said, oh, great, you've been watching too much television, you know. And I heard a shot. And I looked around and you were lying on the seminar floor in a pool of blood. I said, oh, I really do appreciate you calling me and telling me. It's really made my day, you know. Thank you so much. Great friend. And this person said, well, I just thought it was such a vivid dream. I said, well, what are you saying? God is sending me a death threat? It doesn't mesh with my picture of God, so I dismissed it. Later that night, I got a phone call from Los Angeles. And this friend out there said, you know, I had a dream about you last night. And very jokingly, I said, well, I guess I was wearing a dark suit, teaching a seminar. I started to shake. You heard a shot, and I'm lying there in a pool of blood. And there was a deathly silence on the phone. I said, oh, my goodness. And this person said, how could you possibly know that? I said, don't ask me. They said, that's exactly what I dreamt. I said, well, I do appreciate you sharing it. I said to myself, well, that's two. God knows that I place special emphasis symbolically on the number three. So I said, it's only two. So, you know, I still managed to ignore it. That's how hardened I had become. You can actually put anything aside if you want to. You can tuck it away back here somewhere. The Spirit kept striving with me, but I tucked it away back here. A month later, think about this, 1 month later, This gal, Lebanese gal, works in the World Bank, been part of our group there for several years, but never actually become a Christian, but very attracted by it. Beautiful person. She got back from Cambodia. She called me up and she said, "I need to see you." I said, "Okay." She said, "Could you have lunch with me tomorrow at the World Bank?" I said, "Well, certainly. It sounds urgent." She said, "It's very urgent." And because she's an executive, she said, "We'll have lunch in the executive dining room." I said, "Okay, I enjoy the executive dining room very much." So I met her in the executive dining room at the World Bank. Great service, great food and everything. We're sitting there having this meal, and I said, "Well, what's up?" She said, "Well, it's a month ago." I said, "Well, you were in Cambodia." She said, "Yes, I was in Cambodia. And I was awakened one night." And she said, "You know that I'm not fully into Christianity yet." I said, "Yes, I know that." She said, "But I have opened my heart to the things of Jesus." I said, "I know that too." She said, "Well, it was like an angel." She said, "I'm not sure if I dreamt this or I saw it. It was so real." And this is a woman who's not given to any kind of exaggeration. She said, "This creature came and just sat on the end of my bed. It was so light." I said, "How long ago did you say this was?" She said, "Well, I can tell you the exact night." I said, "Well, tell me in US terms, what evening was it?" And she mentioned the same night. By now I knew. And she said, "And this angel showed me a picture of you." I said, "Yes, and I probably know exactly what he showed you." She said, "You couldn't possibly know." I said, "Well, would you like me to tell you?" And I described the dream to her, and she was, the blood drained out of her face. She said, "Well, how could you possibly?" I said, "This is the third time I've heard it, all on the same night. God must be very concerned about me, wouldn't you say? He now has my attention." She said, "But that wasn't the end of the dream." I said, "Really?" She said, "No, there was an extra bit. The angel turned to me and the angel said, 'You're very concerned about Bill, aren't you?'" And she said, "Yes." And the angel said to her, "Well, don't be alarmed," he said. "That is not his blood." I said, "Oh, thank you so much for sharing that." So this was a new bit that was not in the other two dreams. This was not his blood. So I thanked her for sharing it with me, and I began to reflect seriously now. What was God saying to me? So I called my pastor and his wife. His wife claims to have the gift of interpreting dreams, and this was a unique opportunity to put her gift to the test, I thought. So I called up the pastor's wife, who are very good friends of mine, and I said, "You know, I have a challenge for you. I have a dream that needs interpreting, and it's very personal. So the interpretation is going to make a serious impression upon me. So treat it carefully." And I shared the dream with her. I said, "You probably need time to ponder this." She said, "Not at all. It's crystal clear." I said, "Well, I'm glad it's clear to you." She said, "Well, you've been teaching us symbols." She said, "The blood is obviously the symbol of Jesus' death." I said, "Well, yes, I had already assumed that." And then she said to me, "Are you holding back on God with something in your life?" I said, "Why would you say that?" My guilt must have been showing. And she said, "Well, it appears to me that God is saying that he wants your total death to self through the blood of Jesus. And the only reason he would send a dream like this three times is for some reason you are unwilling to give God the freedom to totally crucify yourself." She said, "What are you holding back on?" I said, "Okay, it's true. I am holding back on God, and I need to go and repent immediately." And I went and repented, and of course I went and read that little prophet, and I immediately did what the little prophet was urging me to do. And great peace flooded back into my life again. And I said to myself, "Thank you, God, for using such an unlikely means on one who has been kicking against the pricks." And I should have known all along that the things that you were goading me with, that I took as painful and harmful, they were actually in my best interest all along. And now that your grace is back upon me, I'm free to respond to those pricks, and I want to tell you the joy returned into my life. Anyone here been kicking against the pricks? I'm challenging you today. This is a serious matter. We're looking at how God perseveres even with the most stubborn of his children. What have we learned this morning? Number one, expect opposition. Don't be thrown for a loop by it. Expect it. Even expect where it's going to come from. And instead of it overpowering you, it may become the means of something magnificent developing in your life. Secondly, God uses the most unlikely means to reach his erring children. Thirdly, God has incredible perseverance. It doesn't matter how far in the pit we may be. I have news for you this morning. God will be down there in the pit with you, provoking, convicting, urging, until you finally say, okay, I can't resist your love any longer. When I went out and repented that night, I said, God, forgive me, because I've actually deprived you of my fellowship for 6 months. I thought it was painful and difficult, and I should have known that you were simply trying to reveal your love to me in a more profound manner. And as I acted on my faith, healing came into someone else's life as well as my own. I should have known that. God never asks of us that which will not glorify him, does he? That's his specialty. And the final point, it is hard. I've never been more miserable in my life than those 6 months, believe me. It's hard to kick against the pricks. It's much easier to recognize that God is in fact only endeavoring to keep us on a path that will lead to life eternal. That's his goal. Anyone applying this to their own lives this morning? There's four incredible points here. And out of this, we have the makings of the Apostle Paul, upon whom these four things were done. And a man who was the greatest enemy of Christianity became its greatest champion.